From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in meaningful Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Ashley Phipps, producer of the game Clock Out at 2, to discuss depicting mental health and discrimination in games. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start. Welcome, Ashley, to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about this because I think that it's not we talk about it periodically on the show, mm-hmm. actually all the time, but like not explicitly.
Well, there's angles to it. There's within the industry, and then there's how games impact people on this dimension, and then there's also depicting in the games itself.
Exactly,
which is it sounds like where we're headed today.
Yeah. And so, like, I think that there's a way to, like, approach it. I'm curious how y'all have actually approached these topics in your games. But I would first like to ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners.
Yeah, of course. My name's Ashley Phipps. I am the lead producer on Clock Out at 2, a game in development right now. I'm also a higher education professional and a Twitch streamer.
Awesome. Higher education. Whoa. What? Is that college?
I think so.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
What do you teach?
So my background's actually in student affairs, which is kind of the everything but teaching of colleges and universities. So I spent a few years in housing. I was 7 years an academic advisor for psychology majors. Okay. And right now I'm a program coordinator for an academic advising program at a small private college.
But also very fitting because that is how on earth you survive college because you have to exist kind of full time at college. And at some point you're not studying. A lot of points you're not studying, mm-hmm. but people don't really think about that necessarily. Feels like it fits very absolutely. Well with what you're working on now.
Yeah, and I did actually teach our kind of like orientation class for psychology majors. That was the like how to be a college student class. Mm-hmm. And some of my background is in psychology. So a lot of this is very full circle for me working on a game like this.
Neat.
Cool. So can you describe like the scope and depth of your work with respect to depicting mental health and discrimination in games?
Yeah, so like my work personally or
I suppose the work that the game that you feel the game is doing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I have a little bit of background in psychology and a lot of my kind of graduate training was in as far as like college student age, how their brains work and what mental health issues they might be grappling with. But it's also just been a big passion area for me. I have always been a big proponent of going to therapy for pretty much everybody. I've done it myself for years. And I just feel like it's really important to talk about mental health openly. And so when I got asked to join this project, I actually joined a couple of months after they started on it. They didn't have a producer for the first couple of months. I was really excited because mental health and workplace trauma specifically is something that's very near and dear to my heart. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the goal of this game is to, it's sort of twofold. It's partially to help people maybe work through or grapple with their own workplace trauma. And also just see that as a thing. A lot of folks don't realize that you can legitimately be traumatized by a job. And, you know, there are folks who have PTSD symptoms from things they've experienced at work. Right. And a lot of people don't realize that. And then we also want folks who maybe haven't had that experience to see it laid out in front of them and understand why that might be the case for others in their lives. And, you know, as far as the scope, we're really focusing in on microaggressions and how that affects people at work. So our main character is a woman of color, and there's just a lot that comes along with having those identities in general and in the workplace, especially. Mm-hmm. She's kind of in a big generic corporate machine sort of job. And she experiences just kind of the full range of microaggressions. And we try to work through that in a way that is realistic, but it's also a horror game. So there's a little bit of supernatural built into it as well.
Well, I mean, she's also a Afro-Latina woman as well. So she's got a lot of intersectionality built into that identity, which then also I imagine can broaden and also add barbs to a lot of the discrimination that she's experiencing in the game, at least. Yeah, just because there's so many of those facets, and also just frankly being a woman in a corporate workspace.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. There's in our demo right now, we brought it to GDC, and a lot of people who played it, they would meet one of the male characters in the game, and initially were like, oh, cool, this guy looks cool. And then as they interacted with him, they were like, no, he is very much not cool. Oh, I do not want a sticker with his face on it. No.
Yeah. Oh, you had stickers with his face?
Oh, no.
The irony. We had stickers with all the characters, but his were the ones that took the longest to give away.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
we learned from that experience.
Well, it's probably a good sign of the effectiveness of the game, right?
For sure.
Yeah, that's true.
Absolutely. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, people really loved Celia. They loved the main character. All those stickers went fast.
Okay.
And not so much Mark.
So when, in general, when games depict these topics, what do they often get wrong? And is there anything that they actually get right that you've maybe seen or drawn from for the production of this game?
You know, I think that there has been a lot of change in this area in recent years. And I, you know, personally attribute that to the rise of indie devs and people who are specifically trying to focus on these kinds of topics and making it a point from the beginning. I think in older games, we maybe see a lot of like, oh, this character is insane or a sociopath or like, you know, the very like sexy sort of, with, for lack of a better word, mental illnesses. And I've seen a lot more smaller games coming out, more intimate games that deal with mental health topics, you know, topics of microaggressions and race and gender and things like that a lot more sensitively and accurately. And I think part of that comes from the diversification of the game dev community in general. Like when we have people who have actually had those experiences writing and developing the games, it's a lot easier to get accurate presentation. You know, I think it's hard to talk about like what do people do right or wrong, because you know, everyone's experiences are a little bit different. I think what I personally dislike is very like monolithic characters, right?
Yeah.
So when you see someone as who has portrayed as, you know, the black character, and they are all of the things that you would associate with blackness all in one and nothing else. And I think that what we're trying to do with Celia is make her this multidimensional person. I mean, like you said, she is Afro-Latina, so she already has this kind of like mixed family, and she deals with some of the pressures from both sides of her family. She is a woman in the workplace, yes, but like she also has female friendships that she has that she can lean on. And, you know, she has other co-workers that she has a more complicated relationship with, that is maybe not just that like, oh, you love them or you hate them, but it's like, you have been helpful to me, but also sometimes you throw me under the bus and I'm not sure how to feel about you.
Yeah.
Like more complex feelings, because that's how we work as humans.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it speaks to the strength of smaller teams, that like indie teams, to be able to focus on like more specific topics such as these. Because I think that like, as you get games, as you get teams that are much larger, it becomes more difficult to like, keep the scope in focus on a specific thing. And like, you have to have somebody who's very driven, and the whole team has to be very driven to well depict that information.
And often you end up trying to serve a market of users.
Right.
And so you, that I think is one of the reasons why you end up with these genericized ethnic characters.
Yeah.
Because the specificity gets lost, and then the team is so big that like, nobody is willing to say that whose story it is.
Yeah.
In that sense. And so it kind of get this. So, because there's an inherent contradiction in saying like, well, we don't want to depict a character whose role is to be of a marginalized group.
Yeah.
But that is actually the story you're telling in this game. So you actually are doing that, and very deliberately so. And so there's an inherent kind of push and pull on that. And it sounds like, yeah, the team size is probably part of that. where you get to sort of fearlessly say this is about that without what often the sort of ham-fisted attempts to depict blackness or womanhood or something in a way that is not authentic because it's done either to check a box or to avoid getting too close to the topic.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get to tell the story in a personal way that people will respect because you are the ones telling that story, and it's just a few of you. Well, I keep speaking as though I know how big your team is. I guess I don't actually know. How large is your team?
It is very small. Okay. We have, you know, 5 or 6 core members and then some other folks who have contributed but are not, you know, consistently with the team.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is, you know, I think what's helpful too is that we have multiple Latino women on our team. We have multiple Black people on our team. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's not just this one story that's being told. It's kind of a combination of people. Our CEO is also the narrative writer for the most part, and he really works hard to try and bring in experiences from lots of different people. And, you know, even as we work to include additional characters, talking to folks, we've talked about, you know, we want to include a queer character. Mm-hmm. And my experience as a queer person is pretty, you know, it's just mine.
Right,
it's
right,
very monolithic and very different from a lot of other people. And so mm-hmm. we have talked about, you know, working with other groups. We worked with Queerty at GDC on an event that they held. And so we've talked to them about, you know, finding some folks to interview and get some additional workplace experiences to kind of tie together so that it's not just one person's story, but kind of an amalgamation as much as we can, you know, in one character.
It sounds like you want enough people to be able to relate to the characters and the experiences that are happening in the game without making it so broad that it feels like you're speaking for all experiences.
Right.
I actually want to go back to when you use the word sexy, because I do think that there's a lot of attractiveness to there being simplicity, especially when it, the first thing I thought was like, oh, when it comes to mental health, there's the monolithic, like he's a psychopath. There's the unequivocally, this is a bad person. This is a dangerous person. And then there's also the he's so broken, I can fix him trope.
Ah, yeah.
But then also, and that made me think when you're taking a lot of care with the main character and her intersectionality when you're, and there's this guy named Mark who seems very bad. How have you also tried to resist the temptation to boil down other characters who are less savory so they aren't the monolithic bad or monolithic, this is their thing, they are trouble? Because that also seem, if I can imagine that if you had just this person is unequivocally X, that would also kind of undermine the work that you're doing with Celia and with the other people that you're trying to pull into the cast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, the whole idea is to show how these systems are bad for everyone.
Yeah. Right?
Like the villain of the story is not Mark. It's not, you know, Miss Wong. It's not any of the other characters. It is this corporate system is oppressing everybody in one way or another. And so, you know, we have all the characters have backstories. You might not know them all yet in the demo that we have out, but there's certain things that you get to start seeing, things like, you know, Miss Wong. So she's an Asian woman who started out as one of Celia's good friends and in the workplace and eventually kind of becomes one of the ones who threw her under the bus. And part of that is her own fear of, you know, if they no longer see me as the model minority or, you know, the like I'm the only Asian woman in this office and I can't risk not being trustworthy to all of these other people around me. And she had to make a choice. And you know, I think a lot of us have to make those tough choices and decide which sides of us we show and who we're going to be close to and in life in general. But again, like especially in the workplace.
I think that's a really cool way to think about how do you start making conflict as opposed to like the, I think a lot of in horror games, the conflict stems from this person has this mental illness and it makes them act like this. Having it be the system is bad and it's leading to people to act like this or feel this way is such a small like difference, but such a significant one. Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
Yeah, I like the way you framed that, Lydia, because, like, yeah, it oftentimes is, like, this thing is scary because mental health thing, but it's more, like, I like that, like, the system is scary, and so, like, that causes other things to be additionally scary.
And also the mental health thing is scary for the person experiencing it.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you want to tell a story, and you want them, you don't want them to immediately interpret in a literal sense.
Yeah.
You want to give them a little bit of a hint of there's a deeper meaning here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like you're making every step to make, because it's very easy to build that into your narrative. It's mm-hmm. another matter to actually deliver that to the user.
Right.
And that's a huge challenge. Can you talk a little bit about how you validate that, either with playtesters or even just amongst your team, of like, is this getting through to people?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the playtesting we've done so far has been kind of live at events. So we've gone to a few conferences. I was at MDev in Wisconsin last year. I've mentioned JDC a couple of times. We did a couple events there, tabling. And so we get a lot of just verbal feedback from folks as we do those playtests. We're actually working on our first kind of large scale virtual playtest coming up pretty soon to get some more formalized feedback and you know, a survey format and that sort of thing and recordings. But so far, you know, we've both, you know, caught some bugs just from the informal playtesting, but also gotten really good feedback. You know, there was a lot of people who were saying, you know, I'm not usually a horror game person, but I'm intrigued by the theme of this. And a couple of people who didn't finish the demo because it was a little too visceral for them.
Sure.
Which isn't necessarily not what we're going for. So but it is interesting to see different people's reactions and how they relate personally to Celia. In fact, at GDC, we had a couple different people who compared it to sort of a combination of Get Out and Severance, which I thought was interesting. And I haven't watched Severance myself yet, but it's on my list and I know kind of the concept. And so I thought that was intriguing that to me, it indicates that the people who are trying out our game are also interested in that media, and this kind of narrative is becoming more and more common. This is what people want to see and hear about a little bit more, you know?
Yeah.
Can I ask what the audience for the game is that you're looking for? Because you brought that up a little bit a few times when you were talking just there.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think the audience is, like I said, kind of twofold. One is the people who have experienced things like this and have workplace trauma, or at least just have had a bad experience and are interested in seeing that experience in a game. But also, you know, people who just want to understand others more. Mm-hmm. So maybe that is, you know, I worked a lot with psychology students. And so I think about all of these aspiring mental health professionals that I saw and how a lot of them wanted to go into the field because of either a personal experience they had with mental health or that a family member, a close friend had.
Yeah.
And so for those kinds of people who are like, I want to know more about what this is like for the people in my life, I think it could be useful.
Okay.
But we've also been toying with the idea of using it as an HR tool. Mm-hmm. We've had a couple of different people reach out for, you know, to start talking about a build that could be used as a training sort of situation. Our CEO, Mac, has done a couple talks with a psychologist who specializes in workplace trauma. And we have a kind of mini demo that we wrote specifically for those talks as well.
Okay, cool.
That's interesting. I mean, there's the other dimension to that, and I think you speak to it with the sort of potential of its other use case. I would suspect, I don't know, but it sounds like you would want to tone down a lot of the horror elements in that version so that it mm-hmm. works more broadly for an audience that you cannot predict because it has a function. So when you think about the game generally, are you comfortable with the fact that there will be people who you could reach who you won't because they're not interested in horror games?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, no game is going to reach every person.
Yeah. Right.
I myself am not a big horror game player.
me neither. So
Yeah. I actually, so I mentioned that I didn't join the team before development started. I joined a little later. Mm-hmm. It actually started as a game jam game for Spooktober 23, was when the idea initially came to be. And I played that game jam version on my stream because I just happened to hear through the grapevine that they had created it, and I thought it sounded intriguing. And I do demo days where I just play a few different random demos of indie games. And I knew it was a horror game, but it's also, you know, a visual novel, and I like those. So I was like, sure, like, I'm intrigued. I'll try it out. And I still really liked it because it's not jump scary, which is kind of the types of horror that I don't love. It's more psychologically scary, which is what I do enjoy. And but yeah, I mean, I think that there will probably be people who are scared away by that label, and that's okay. But I also found that even the people that we have, you know, when we were doing those live play tests, the people who were like, I don't know if this sounds like my vibe, but I know someone who I think would love it. Right. I feel like everyone has a friend who is like the horror fiend, right? Like one of my best friends.
Yeah.
I just went to Sinners with them last night, which is not one that I would have maybe gone to on my own, but because my friends wanted to, I did. It was fantastic. But I think that it's a very popular genre, and, you know, it'll find the people that will relate to it through the grapevine, I think.
That's fair. That's fair. I think on the other end of the spectrum, has there been any, I'm curious your thoughts on, like, the idea that, like, I don't know how best to frame this question, so I'll just explain it on my own perspective. I oftentimes will, like, go to a movie because it's featuring a bunch of black people in it, and they oftentimes will talk about black trauma and stuff. And as a black person, I'm aware of black trauma already, and I don't really need a refresher on how it is.
Yeah. That movie's for me, not for you.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, the movies are made for black audiences in that way, to, like, you know, to show black people, but also they, you know, show experiences that black people don't need to see. So I'm curious your thoughts on, like, that idea that, like, maybe people will go into the game already having experienced these things or knowing about these things and won't get, I guess, new knowledge or information from the game as a result of that.
Can I, like, try to rephrase that?
Yes,
so,
please.
So there's, like, you want to acknowledge the tapestry of someone's identity and make them feel seen or at least invite them the ability to feel seen.
Right.
But you don't need to remind them and re-traumatize them in the process of feeling seen. Is that kind of what you're going for?
Yeah, that's what I'm going for.
Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I guess, can you, I'm asking you your thoughts on that topic specifically.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the one of the ways that we try to make it not so just like, let's just talk about trauma and nothing else is, you know, there is an underlying plot, and it's a secret, but you know, the purpose of the game, like the entertainment value of the game, like, because it's still supposed to be a game that people play because they enjoy horror games or you know, visual novel type games.
Sure. Yeah.
The purpose is not to just come out of it being like, cool, that was a game about trauma. It's to be like, oh, that was a really cool story, and also made me think about how workplace trauma affects me or affects other people.
Okay.
And so the idea is, by the time you get to the end, it's just been a really cool, creepy story that's a little bit, you know, sci-fi, maybe a little bit.
Yeah. So it's like you're centering it not as the driver of the plot, but as the like the circumstances, the raising the stakes of the situation. Because I keep thinking about, like, the people who say Get Out and Severance, very much and also just the idea of corporate life in general, feeling trapped and stuck, and that adding those hazards in the place you are stuck sounds like very similar. Like, you're stuck in an environment that is not safe, and that is it, that sounds like where you're putting it, as opposed to saying this is the main point of the plot, this is the thing that's driving the story forward. It's what's making the plot have stakes to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love like the use of stuck, because at the very beginning, there is like your first choice that you get to make, because, you know, visual novels always have these choices that kind of drive the narrative. Mm-hmm. The very first choice you get to make is whether or not to get on the elevator in the office building and actually like go up to your floor. Mm-hmm. But it's also the only choice where you really have no choice, because if you say, no, I don't want to get on the elevator, you end up having to anyway.
Right. Yeah.
Very minor spoiler, but you know, because most people can't just choose not to go to work. Right.
Yeah. Like,
no matter how you feel, no matter how crappy it is, you have to go, because that's the world that we live in.
Yeah. I think that the desire to have empathy for people in situations, but also that sort of universal experience that you're sort of hinting at as well, you do kind of want that to sneak up on players a little bit, because it's not, because the game has a plot and a story and a drive, and that's what you want people to like get through, right? That's the motivation people have.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a little bit of a tension because you have those two audiences.
Mm-hmm.
You want to have people be able to feel seen and heard and related to, who have suffered these aggressions, but you also don't want to make re-traumatize them or make it all about that. But then your other audience of people who you want to empathize with those people, or to see what their part in the system, you also don't want to trivialize those things too much and make that trauma their entertainment.
Mm.
Right.
Because that's also a danger. So do you, in the team, do you talk about that push and pull, or is it just, because I would think it would be a totally justifiable thing to say, like, we're storytellers, we need to feel it out, we shouldn't be micro analyzing every choice we make to see where it fits. Sure. But I can imagine that's something that would be on your mind a lot working on a game like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it evolves more, I don't know what word to use for it, but just like kind of naturally as we go along.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I said, Matt kind of plots it out and does a script. And then, you know, once a new scene gets added, we will all kind of play through it and talk through it and things like that. Not necessarily like microanalyze, but just in a like, does the vibe fit?
Sure,
sort of way, you know, is this really getting at what we want it to get at? And we've made some big changes to the plot, you know, over the course of the year and a half that we've been working on it. And we've got the overarching themes and everything really solidified now, but the specific points still kind of evolve and change as we go along. And one thing that really I haven't mentioned much yet, but that is also another big piece of it, is the self-care aspect.
Yeah.
Which is a big mechanic in the game. And we think it's important to show how important self-care is, you know, like I think people talk about it, but they don't necessarily always know what it looks like for different people. And so, you know, we try to show different aspects of self-care, but also the limits of self-care.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, so there's this mechanic where you have a stress meter, and as it goes up, you know, you can use self-care to get it to go down. But at a certain point, if your stress gets too high, even, you know, going out into the garden and getting fresh air is not going to help.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, like, you're just burned out, and you just, nothing is going to make it, you know, go down for that day.
Yeah.
And that's part of why we've added both that mechanic and the kind of roguelike aspect, or roguelite aspect, I suppose, of replaying a day in the workplace over and over again until you manage to actually like figure out the story and meet your goals.
Hey, Steven, what are you wearing on your torso?
A shirt.
Whoa.
Yeah.
But you know what would make that shirt cooler?
What?
If it had our logo on it.
It would be cooler if I had a logo. Yeah.
Is that even possible, you guys?
I don't know.
Dang.
I don't know if science has achieved this yet.
I bet Mark has.
Yeah, have I?
Yes.
it's right here in my notes. Yes, please go to nicegames.club/merch. This is the smoothest transition.
So smooth.
You can pick up one of three items we have in our little mini merch store, you can call it. We have a t-shirt. Very soft, very lovely. Has the logo. Science has solved it.
Yes.
We also have a throw pillow, which has our cartridge logo in it, which is very cool.
Yeah.
Put that in your gaming den. And we also have, of course, Glom, the card game that we made right here on the show that was published in 2023 or 2024. It's so long ago now. I'm really unprepared for this.
It's all good.
It's a very fun game. You should have that. But any of those or any combination of those are available. Oh, no, I forgot the URL. What was it?
Nicegames.club/merch.
Lydia, did you remember it?
Nicegamesclub.com/merch.
Almost.
Oh, no.
Nicegames.club/merch.
Dot club. I was actually curious how working on this game changed how you or your team think about your own mental health. Mm. I know, because especially working, I imagine, on a game in corporate world and making people think about these sorts of things, anecdotally, I know a lot of people close to me in the games industry who have range from, you know, distinct physical stress responses to work to actual literal trauma from workplace incidents, and how it sounds like you're mining and fostering a lot of conversation from people's own experiences in the team. How has this changed your own approach, especially having to dev the game, right? That is a stressful experience creatively and mentally and emotionally.
Yeah. I mean, it has been interesting. And I'm relatively new to the games industry myself. I have a day job in higher ed still. And, you know, all of us on our team are mostly working day jobs and then doing this kind of on the side. And so managing our own mental health is important. And we have been trying to make sure that we're taking care of each other and not burning out all of that, because that'd be incredibly counterproductive to everything that we're trying to do with the game. But also, you know, you just burnt out teams don't make good games. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that's part of why it started as a small project. And when we decided we wanted to expand it into a full game, we thought, oh, it'll take, you know, a year, maybe. You know, we didn't have a huge scope. And now a year and a half in, we think there's probably at least another 6 to 8 months left. And that's, I mean, pretty typical in the game dev world in general. Because we take breaks, you know, we're just coming up on our next 4-week sprint. But next week we're not meeting at all because everyone just needed a breather and, you know, some time. I mean, I'll be working on the backlog and getting some stuff prepared for that sprint, but we're not, you know, meeting up and having our typical 2 nights a week that we, you know, discuss things and work together.
Yeah.
And part of that too is our team is somewhat international. Our CEO lives in Japan, so our meetings have to be in the evening US time. And, you know, we recognize that that's difficult for people sometimes. So we're not, you know, angry if someone has to miss something, and we just catch each other up on Discord or something. And if someone needs to have a one-on-one to hash something out, we, you know, we'll find time to do that instead or something. It's just trying to be really understanding of each other's situations, so that we can make the best game that we can, but also take care of each other's mental health, because it would be incredibly cruel to make a game about taking care of your mental health and then tank your own in the process.
So I'm curious why you decided to pick these ideas in a video game in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is frankly just that is what we know and love is video games. You know, that's all of us have some form of background in them, or at the very least passion. You know, I grew up with everything from Pokemon to Battlefield 1942. Like, my dad would take me and my little brother to LAN parties in his friend's basement, and we would play that and like Unreal Tournament and things like that. And so I have seen the whole gamut of genres and things, and for me personally at least, it feels like a void a little bit of, you know, these more personal stories, which again, like I said before, I think that indie teams especially have been filling that more and more in recent years. I've played lots of really meaningful, wonderful stories in the last few years, but yeah, I mean, we just are game people. We're game makers. And like I said, it just started as a little game jam idea. Yeah, it wasn't supposed to be anything big. That wasn't the intent. But we all just loved it so much that we wanted to keep working on it.
Well, it sounds like you're also taking very obvious and clear advantage of the fact that with games, you can build in and take away agency in very powerful ways, which I think works very well with mental health. I mean, two of my games that I, the positive impact games, because I'm a positive impact game designer, I always point to is Depression Quest and Adventures with Anxiety, because it's so telling the moments when you are asked to make bad decisions or difficult or impossible decisions, and also when you so clearly want to have a decision and you are not afforded that. Just the elevator scene in the moment, the fact that you have that where no matter what, you have to go to work, is there's something very, I think, very visceral and a lot more show don't tell, very more, much more powerful than trying to communicate that only visually with a film or only textually, because then you're just being told, you're not feeling that. That you're not being asked to have to go to work, right? And it sounds like you are taking advantage of a lot of that intuitive sense of agency or lack thereof that you're getting from these games. I mean, that's also a big one for horror games too, right? Like, you're given a bad combat mechanics because you're being asked to be vulnerable.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of why I've always been more of a games person than a movies person. Sure. I love movies and TV, but if I have some free time, I want to play something where I have an impact on the story. I don't always want to just watch something. It depends on, you know, where my mental health is at.
That's fair.
I have, but yeah, you know, I think about, like, yeah, I mentioned just because I went last night to Sinners, you know, you watch a horror movie and you see people making decisions that you wouldn't necessarily make. And then it's great because it does get you thinking about how other people react in those situations and, like, why, you know, they put those choices in there, especially with that kind of movie where they're clearly very intentional with the storytelling. And but I just, I like, you know, being able to make things my own. Yeah. I have on my resume that I am, like, known for spending hours in character creation because the customization is always my, like, favorite part of games. So I think that's part of why it speaks to me too.
Yeah. I think Lydia outlined a kind of a why games, the strength that games have for a thing like this. And so I think maybe a more challenging approach to this question is, what is uniquely difficult about depicting these topics in games that might be easier in other mediums? Because you're game makers, so you're going to make games, right? You do not have to justify that to any audience or anybody. Has the team discussed anything that's, like, because of what the medium we're working in, we have these unique challenges? Is that something you've discussed? Do you have sort of headline, you know, difficulties that, like, oh, if only we were just making this a non-visual novel?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest one that comes to mind, the biggest challenge is with the choices. Like, you can only list out so many choices for people to take. You know, we have up to 4 options for you to do in any given situation. And that doesn't hit on maybe everything that people might do in that situation. So even in playtesting, you know, we've had folks who were like, I don't like any of these options. And part of that is intentional sometimes, you know, sometimes there is a no good option situation. But, you know, like, going back to Mark when he's being creepy, for example, there's a moment where, like, you can kind of choose to either freeze and just, like, let him touch your hand and not do anything, or you fawn and, like, kind of laugh it off and that sort of thing. And you know, there's like these 2 or 3 options. And I had so many people, women especially, who were like, I want to just punch him.
Yeah.
But also, would you realistically punch your coworker in that situation?
Right.
No, like, you want to because it's a game, but that's probably not what most people would choose in real life either.
And then the question then is, and you've said it, part of that is deliberate, right? Like, not giving you that option is a choice. But then you also have no idea what people would want to do. So sometimes not giving them a choice is not intentional. And so that must be very difficult to calibrate, because you are at some points trying to deliberately not give them a choice you might have been able to as a developer.
Yeah, I was actually wondering, when you're making those 4 options, how often do you decide this is because Celia would do this and this is because a player who knows Celia's life experiences or had had similar feelings, this is what they would do.
Mm-hmm. I think that we struggled a little bit with that initially. Our choices actually were not specific phrases. So, you know, a lot of times you're choosing specifically what you're going to say. Our choices were more like, will you be avoidant? Will you be, you know, neutral, or will you be more aggressive? And we've shifted that along the way because we were having some issues with trying to determine like what those choices could look like. And we've shifted them now to align more specifically with the, you know, fight, flight, fawn, freeze, those kind of trauma responses or the types of physical responses that you have to negative situations. And so that has helped us really hone in more on what are the most realistic possibilities for someone who is experiencing this like interaction. So I think that has helped a lot with it, to have a specific like window to look at it through.
I'm really interested to see how you work freeze and fawn in, because I've mentioned on the podcast, I think horror games are wonderful art and I love watching people play them, but I can't, because my fear response is fawn or freeze, and that's not conducive to playing a video game if you just stuck. I have tried. And
right. You can't play Dead by Daylight and just stay in one place.
Exactly. But also because a lot of like quintessential horror games, minus a mechanic where you actually have to stay still, which is kind of sprinkled in, really it focuses on fight or flight. Those are the ones that people think of unequivocally when they think of fear responses. And so I'm really interested to hear how you bring in those other two, because those have started very, very little, but started to come more into public understanding as a fear response.
Yeah. Well, and it's so uncommon for people to understand those other responses that when we were playtesting the newest version with these options, I had so many people who were like, what is fawn? What even is this? And we have little icons next to the options to kind of help people understand what the different things are. And the initial icon that we had listed for fawn, combined with the fact that the demo interactions are mostly with that Mark character, people were like, is fawning flirting? I don't want to flirt with him. Yeah. Like, we had misunderstandings about what that even meant. And so, you know, we've had to kind of go back, and we'll be making some adjustments to that. But yeah, I think those are very realistic responses, and especially the way that women are socialized. You know, that's much more common responses. Like, if anybody is going to, you know, go off and physically punch somebody at work, it's probably going to be a white man, because that's, you know, how they've been socialized more often than not to deal with that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Not women, not people of color necessarily.
Like, yeah. Well, because
less risk.
The protection is, it is safe to be liked. And that is the fundamental core of it. And especially as women, we are conditioned that we are safe if we are liked and if we are polite. And that, and so just laughing politely, moving on, trying to get away from the awkwardness is such a core way that we understand safety. I am curious, actually, though, if you know, or if you've experienced any video games that you feel have actually represented discrimination or mental health in some really good ways, in some very compassionate or empathic ways?
Oh, that's a good question. Gosh, I mean, this might sound odd, but I've very recently gotten into Final Fantasy 14. And I'm not all the way through yet. I'm only in the second expansion. But I do feel like there has been some really interesting and good representation of the traumas of war.
Yeah.
And how that affects both the people involved and the civilians involved. Like, it is a strangely realistic war story, and that was not what I was expecting going into Final Fantasy.
Wow.
You know, having played some of the previous games, but not this one before. There is also a game I really love called The Cosmic Wheel Sisterhood. That is a amazing indie game. It's got these like fantastic pixel graphics, a really cool story. You make your own tarot cards. You're like a witch in this futuristic society. But she's also been isolated as like a punishment, essentially, for years and years and years. And so I think they do a great job of representing what that isolation and depression looks like. Because it's, you know, initially it is a punishment, but also she's kind of self-punishing herself. Like, even when she gets the opportunity to talk to somebody, she's pretty closed off because she doesn't trust anymore and those sorts of things. And there's a ton more to it, and I won't ruin it because I think everybody should play it. But those kind of both sides of the spectrum, like a big, huge AAA game and an indie game, that I like kind of how both of them have dealt with mental health recently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Reminded me, I'll have to dig up this episode if we can't find it. It'll be in the show notes if we find it. But Ellen talked a lot about Hellblade.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Off the top of my head, I don't remember which episode, but we had a really good discussion about that, about like the responsibility of this topic. So that's one that there's not only a lot to experience with the game, but a lot to experience with the discourse about that game.
Right? Oh, yeah. I recently met someone who is a psychologist who has psychosis and has like talked and thought a lot about Hellblade. Mm-hmm. Really, really, it was a cool conversation, but that was some like a very central point for kind of how he thinks about how to talk about it, but also himself.
Right, right.
If you like JRPGs, I'd be very curious your thoughts on Tales of Arise, because one of the major themes is among the character growth for all the characters is confronting bias and like their own biases and confronting their sense of how the world works and such, which is really, really, it's surprisingly sophisticated, but also makes the characters very three-dimensional in a way that was not expected.
Yeah, I'll have to add that one to my list. I haven't played that one.
Also, just Tales games are great.
Just general recommend for...
Yeah, yeah.
You've made me think more deeply about our game now, and lovely. I have some great ideas already to bring to the team, so...
Yay!
That's good. Yeah, it's been great having you. I think mm-hmm. we always love hearing about teams that are thinking deeper about topics that you've seen out in the world superficially.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just good to know that there are people digging deep, because there's so many topics and so many opportunities, and every individual developer only has an opportunity to go so far in so many things.
Right.
So just to hear about other people doing interesting mm-hmm. things, and for people in our audience who are working in topics, check out this game, check out the things we've talked about. Hopefully it's helped you get, you know, think about it a little bit deeper and know that like you can go deeper, right? Because games can be naturally you can go towards the average to just to ship on time.
Yeah.
But is that what you're in it for? So it's just good to hear the dedication to depicting it honestly and with some depth.
That's our show. You can find Ashley online on Twitch, Blue Sky, and Instagram at Schleedily.
You gonna spell that for me, or
it'll be in the show notes.
Okay.
For show notes and additional links from today's conversation, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at Design Surface Area and Future Club. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.